Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Patient Activation Network podcast. My name is Matt Cavallo, and I'm your host. I'm here today with author Michael Becker, who wrote the memoir, A Walk with Purpose. Michael's on here to talk about his journey. And Michael, welcome to the show.
Matt, thanks very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So before we get going, could you tell us just a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. For the last several decades, I've been a serial entrepreneur, C-level industry executive, really focusing on the biotechnology industry. I was fortunate enough to be the CEO of a couple of biotechnology companies that were working in the treatment and diagnosis of cancer, including Cytogen Corporation, which was based in Princeton, New Jersey. And up until December of 2015, things were going pretty well. And that's when I was diagnosed with advanced stage 4 cancer.
Wow. So 2015, December, you're diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. What was the signs and symptoms that led you to believe that maybe there was something wrong?
You know, I think all these cancer stories probably start out the same way. It was, you know, a morning just like every other morning, and I was just about to get in the shower, waiting for the water to warm up. And this was the day before Thanksgiving in 2015, and I just glanced in the mirror and saw something unusual, a large lump on the right side of my neck, and it wasn't there yesterday or the day before, so I put my hand on it, and I could feel it was a solid mass. And what was interesting to me at the time was it wasn't sore to the touch. It wasn't, warm to the touch. It didn't have any symptoms or signs associated with it. And that made me nervous because I figured if it was, an infection or a blocked duct or something like that, you typically get, you know, some soreness or tenderness around it. But this was, you know, purely a solid mass. You could move it around, and it had no sensory associated with it. So with that, I shut off the shower, called my family physician, and got an appointment for that afternoon. And, he tried to console me and say it was just a blocked salivary gland and not necessarily associated with pain or tenderness. Put me on a antibiotic and said, you know, if it's not gone in a week, then go check with the ear, nose, and throat doctor, which I did. And they ended up doing a biopsy and confirmed that it was indeed oropharyngeal cancer, or more commonly known as head and neck cancer, and it was stage 4 because of the progression of the disease. So it started in my right tonsil, and it spread to that lymph node in my neck, which was what I first noticed. And since the cancer had escaped its primary starting point, the right tonsil, that led to the stage 4 diagnosis.
Now, at this time, you are an executive with a biotech firm, and you're going in and out of work for months leading up to this. Was there any things that maybe you didn't see in the mirror, like fatigue or any symptoms that in hindsight maybe you wanted to check out?
No, it's a great question. I thought back about, you know, because you start to get more educated about the disease and learn about the initial symptoms, which are, for this disease, you know, sore throat or hoarseness in your voice, things like that. And I had none of the symptoms. It was completely asymptomatic at diagnosis.
Wow. So this is December, and you're talking to your ear, nose, and throat doctor. Describe to me what you're going through. How are you internalizing this? At what point did you decide, you know, to either, you know, fight it or run away from it? What's your process there?
Well, you know, being around the cancer sector or industry for a while, I was pretty familiar with the different stages and different prognosis for, you know, various cancers. So when I heard stage four, that was really the hard thing to digest, because I knew at that point, you know, that's a stage of cancer that is going to be difficult to eliminate. So my first concern was, you know, here it's very analogous to, for example, ovarian cancer. They typically don't have any signs or symptoms until the disease spread somewhere else, and by that time it's more difficult to treat. So I was in that same boat, but the, you know, my first goal was to get to a academic institution that I knew, you know, would know this cancer inside and out. And for me, that was Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York. And upon my initial visit with them, they were very optimistic. They said that, you know, they've seen a lot of these types of cases, and as long as the cancer is what they said above the collarbone, they felt that they had a very good shot, 80-85% cure rate with chemo radiation. So I actually, you know, it's like they describe it, cancer is a roller coaster. So, you know, the initial diagnosis, stage four, and then, oh, this is eminently treatable. You know, you start to experience the highs and the lows. But I went through the chemo radiation, and sure enough, the first PET scan was completely clean, and it looked like the cancer had been eliminated.
And during this time, you're continuing to work and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, I got an apartment in New York City, which was walking distance to Memorial Sloan Kettering, so I could basically walk over there for my daily zapping, my radiation treatment. And the chemo part of it was basically split into thirds. So I got a round of chemo at the start of radiation, another round of chemo in the middle of radiation, and then a final dose of chemo at the end of radiation. But for seven weeks, I had to go through daily radiation Monday through Friday. So the apartment made it a lot easier to work that into my schedule. And then after that, I would go over and continue with my job, which was based in New York at the time.
So having a leadership role in an organization, you've got a high visibility position. And you're in a unique position in that your company treated things like cancer. How did you approach that subject with your employer at the time?
I think it gave me the ability to be, you know, straightforward and upfront with them about what to expect and what I was willing to do and when I was going to need some, you know, extra help or time off, things like that. But for the most part, they were extremely accommodating. You know, I came in, you know, basically after my radiation, so that was usually first thing in the morning. So I would come into the office around 10 or so, and sometimes due to fatigue, you know, maybe I'd leave early and stuff like that. But you know, working from the apartment, you know, having my laptop, it really gave me a sense of, I don't want to say purpose, but it gave me a sense of normalcy. I felt like my life wasn't, you know, turned completely upside down. I had my job, I had my work, I had things keep me busy and distracted all through that process. And of course, most importantly, had my wife and family to support me as well. And they came and visited on weekends, or my wife actually took time off and stayed with me in New York for the last part of the radiation therapy when things get fairly ugly in terms of side effects.
So as this is happening and things go away on the PET scan, what was your key to notice when they returned, or how did you find out that they returned?
Yeah, I'd like to describe myself as not an optimist or a pessimist, but a realist. And when I got the encouraging PET scan results, I couldn't help but think in the back of my mind, you know, is it really that easy? Did I just go through, you know, 7 or 8 weeks of unadulterated hell with the radiation and the chemotherapy, and that's it? And then, you know, I'm cancer free, and sure, I have to have a PET scan every 6 months or so to monitor, but it was unsettling for me that it was that simple. And believe me, I'm not minimizing the effect of the 7 or 8 weeks of chemo radiation, but I just felt fortunate that if that's all I had to go through and be cured of cancer, then I was pretty fortunate. But it was that sense of it can't be that easy that left me with, you know, in the back of my mind, kind of that knowing thought that, you know, the cancer is going to come back at some point in time.
And had the lump decreased? Were there any physical signs that the radiation was working?
Excellent question. I from maybe week two or so of the chemo radiation, noticed a pretty dramatic decrease in the size of the lump on the side of my neck. So it was very encouraging to be able to see the effects of the treatment. I really can't imagine, you know, somebody with, for example, a bloodborne cancer or something that you can't monitor or see the effect or notice the effect. So it was great to actually, you know, watch, look in the mirror and see that lump decreasing during the course of the chemotherapy. And by 7 weeks, 8 weeks, it was just about gone.
And by seeing that decrease, did it make the side effects of the chemo and the radiation a little bit more tolerable?
Yes and no. I mean, it was certainly a morale boost to see the lump decreasing. But the further, you know, every day you got into the treatment, you know, the closer you got to the end of the 7 or 8 week period, the effects of the chemotherapy and the radiation are cumulative. So literally day one, you feel perfectly fine. Nothing's happened. You know, this is going to be a cakewalk. And then, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, it's really about 4 weeks into it that you start to really feel the effects. And they're severe. I mean, you get ulcers inside your mouth. They can be debilitating to the point where you can't chew food, you can't speak, you can't swallow liquids, you get them in your throat. Externally, your skin on the neck becomes very irritated and red. In some cases, it starts peeling. I was fortunate not to have that. So it's a, you know, it's Michael Douglas, the actor that also had been diagnosed with the same cancer, I think described it best when he said it was analogous to the seven circles of hell. every week seemed to be just a little bit worse, a little bit worse, and by week 7 or 8, you're just like, okay, I don't know how much more I can handle, but fortunately, it gets better after that.
And then, after all that, it came back. Speak a little bit about what happened when you found out it was back and what you decided to do as a result.
Yeah, that was a real, obviously, disappointing outcome, but the PET scans were scheduled for every 6 months. So June of 2016, everything was fine. That was the clean PET scan. And then December of that same year was the second PET scan. And that one, basically, my lungs lit up like a Christmas tree. And I saw that image on the PET scan, and I've seen, you know, my share of radiology images over the years being in the industry, in particular being involved with cancer. So I knew exactly what it was I was looking at, and I knew that was going to be a problem, because now the cancer had gone below the collarbone, and once it gets into the lungs, it's going to be difficult to you know, eradicate or to treat. So the bad PET scan, I guess, was you know, unexpected, so soon or so close in proximity to the June PET scan that looked, you know, for all intents and purposes, great.
So, at this point, are you still at Sloan, or are you trying to find people that specialize in this specific version of cancer? What is that journey like?
Well, the first conversation was with my medical oncologist, Dr. David Pfister at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and, you know, we talked about the various treatment options, and including clinical trials, and one that they had proposed was a combination of a checkpoint inhibitor called Opdivo, which is approved for head and neck cancer. But they were suggesting a clinical study where they would use that in combination with targeted radiation to maybe one or two nodes within the lungs, basically to try to get a synergistic response. So the radiation was supposed to help in some way, shape, or form Opdivo do its job. And I thought it was an interesting approach because I had done a lot with radiation over the years at Cytogen and some of the other companies. So I understood the synergy or potential synergy between radiation and the immunotherapy. But what I didn't like was that it was a randomized trial. It was one-for-one randomization. So I had a 50-50 shot of getting either Opdivo or Opdivo plus radiation. And that didn't sit well with me. I didn't like those odds given the stage of the cancer. So that prompted me to open up my Rolodex and start to, you know, explore other options, at least see what was, you know, what else was available. And fortunately, Dr. James Scully at the NIH, who is a renowned researcher in the area of immunology, we had collaborated at Cytogen and knew each other well. So I called him up and gave him my update. He was aware of the original diagnosis, but I told him what the new information was. And lo and behold, he was doing a solid tumor. He was the principal investigator on a solid tumor study with an experimental drug called M7824, which is basically Opdivo with a added benefit of what they call a TGF-beta trap. But basically, it's a twofer. So you get two drugs or two ways to attack the cancer with one antibody. So I felt that was, when compared to what Memorial Sloan Kettering was proposing, and that was not a randomized study, so I was guaranteed to get the experimental drug. I felt that was a better fit for me personally. And, you know, that's a real tough position, I think, for somebody that doesn't have biotech experience or clinical trial background to really be their own advocate. I think it's very difficult, or would be very difficult, to navigate that, know what was, you know, better, know what randomization meant, and things like that. So part of my goal or objectives is to really try to get people to take a look at clinical trials. I think they're a great way to find out about new experimental therapies that might offer better quality of life or other benefits that currently available treatments don't offer.
Now, where could our listeners go to take advantage or learn what kind of clinical trials are available to them?
The best place is clinicaltrials.gov, which is a website that maintains, you know, all of the active clinical trials by phase of development, by the disease that they're treating, the institutions that are involved in the trial, what the randomization is, everything that you would want to know is there. Unfortunately, you know, for me, it was very easy to navigate, but for other cancer patients, I've heard complaints that it's a cumbersome website to navigate, or it's difficult to navigate. But nonetheless, that is the one-stop shopping for what's going on in clinical development for a specific cancer.
And that's great. That's a great resource. And I would imagine that there would be some help, is there some help if they have trouble navigating it?
Yeah, I mean, I think if the patient in question brings the results of what they found or a trial that they're interested in or looks appealing, I'm sure that if they discuss that with their physician, with their medical oncologist, that they'll get additional insight or input on whether it's right for them or what the pros and the cons are. So my advice is always, you know, go first to the people that know the most, which are your treating physicians, as opposed to reading too much into what you find on the internet.
That's great. That's a great resource. Thank you for that. So I want to shift gears here just a little bit. And, you know, a lot of times when things happen to us that are outside of our controls, you know, we always wonder what that origin was. Was there ever a point in your diagnosis where you came to learn how you had got cancer?
Yeah, and it was extremely surprising to me. So my cancer, oropharyngeal cancer, squamous cell carcinoma, actually originated from a relatively common virus called HPV, or human papillomavirus. We tend to think of that HPV with or associated with sexually transmitted diseases and genital warts and things like that. But there's a whole subset called oral HPV, and oral HPV can be transmitted a variety of different ways. Certainly, it can be transmitted sexually, but there's also there are questions regarding whether it can be transmitted via saliva. So, you know, open mouth kissing or drinking from an infected glass or bottle. There's just not enough research that's been done on how exactly oral HPV is transmitted. But I did find out that my cancer has the HPV marker, so it was birthed or arose from the HPV virus. And that, I had no idea that I had HPV. I had, you know, there was no test, there was no symptom. And when you start digging a little bit underneath, you know, the hood of HPV, you find out that there are close to 80 million people in the United States right now that have some form of HPV and don't even know it. There's no, you know, blood test or screening test in existence right now. So you don't know if your partner or somebody that you're involved with is a carrier. We don't know how, as I mentioned, oral HPV is transmitted. So you've got a virus that has a lot of unanswered questions, but one that has been answered very emphatically is that the current vaccines, the HPV vaccines, would be able to prevent, or would have prevented my cancer and can prevent the six different types of cancer that HPV can cause.
Wow. So let's break that into a couple different pieces. So there is no way, there's no blood test or any kind of screening. Say you're not symptomatic, there's no screening to let you know whether or not you have HPV. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then I've been seeing these commercials on TV, and I'm a dad, and they're in line with kind of this message where a person has cancer, then they walk them back till they're about 12 years old, and it says something like, if you had known this, would you have given me this vaccine? I don't remember the exact commercials. Is there a lot of data on this vaccine? It's something, at least in my, where I'm at, is relatively new. Maybe it's just new because I've not been focused on it, but as a parent of a 7 and 9 year old, what advice might you give me?
Well, the HPV vaccines have been around for a while, and they've made, you know, improvements and changes to them over the years. But there's two or three that are on the market right now, and both of them include a vaccination for HPV 16, which is the subtype that is involved with most of the cancers, so, head and neck cancer, cervical cancer, things like that. But the HPV vaccines were originally developed to prevent cervical cancer. So many people tend to associate HPV more with women than with men. And I think for you as a father of boys, the HPV vaccine might not have even been on your radar screen because, you know, you're clearly not worried about cervical cancer and and your sons. But now that there's more information and we know more about head and neck cancer, and in particular it's linked to HPV, there's now a very strong rationale for vaccinating both boys and girls with the HPV vaccine. And, you know, it's a very personal choice. For me, we had discussed vaccinating our two daughters prior to my diagnosis, and I have to admit, at that point I'm going, you know, do my kids really need another vaccine? Are we over-vaccinating? Is there, you know, going to be a side effect and things like that? And it wasn't until, you know, clearly I got diagnosed that I dug into it a little bit more and became very comfortable with the fact that they should be vaccinated. But, you know, you've got a lot of different things going against a average parent deciding to vaccinate their children. You have the anti-vaccine movement, which rightfully or wrongfully is, you know, scaring a lot of parents into not vaccinating for measles and other various illnesses. And you're starting to see a resurgence in some of those. We had thought that we wiped out measles in the year 2000, and just recently it's been making a comeback in several states. So this is clearly, you know, the downside to not vaccinating. But for the HPV vaccine, you're also talking about a sexually transmitted disease for the most part. So parents, you know, are reluctant to vaccinate their children because they're concerned that it's giving them carte blanche, or, you know, the okay to go be sexually active, because now you don't have to worry about contracting HPV. And I think that's a, you know, a poor way to look at it, given the side effects and the ultimate risk of the six different types of cancers that you can get from that disease.
Yeah, so that's fascinating. A question just popped into my mind about, you know, is this a vaccine that you need to get before you're sexually active?
You do. The suggestion is to vaccinate boys and girls at age 11 or 12, with the assumption that they're not sexually active at that age. And clearly, you can vaccinate older than that, actually up to age 26 for women, and I think up to age 21 for young men. But in that case, you need three vaccinations as opposed to two. But to your point, if you've already been sexually active and you've already been exposed to the HPV virus, the vaccine isn't going to do you any good.
And I was reading prior to this interview a little bit about HPV because I'm not too familiar with it, and thank you for this great education today. It's said that almost everyone in the population at some time will have HPV, you know, or at least a high percentage of it, but then the body can naturally take care of it. Could you speak a little bit about that Have you heard that?
Yes, absolutely. About 9 out of 10 people with HPV will just have the virus be attacked by your body, and the HPV virus will be eradicated. So 9 out of 10 times, HPV doesn't pose a problem for the individual. But it's that one, you know, it's that 10% that you know, can be really tricky and really problematic. So we get about 14 million new cases each year. I mentioned that there's about 80 million walking around right now with it. And, you know, 90% of those people are going to be just fine. But 10% are going to get this HPV 16 genotype, and that's the one that's associated with these aggressive cancers.
And do you know whether or not they're trying to develop some kind of screening process to be able to have some kind of early detection of this?
Well, for women, they do the Pap smear, which is actually not looking at the HPV virus itself. They're looking for its effect on cells. And so what they're looking at are some of the cells that look precancerous or cancerous. So right now, I'm not aware of any screening test or screening mechanism for the HPV virus itself. It would be great, wouldn't it, if you could know if your partner is HPV positive or not, and make your decisions on that basis of information. But not right now, and not as far as I know, are any in development.
Yeah, well, we all appreciate the education on HPV. It's definitely a topic that should be discussed more, you know, and it is uncomfortable talking to your primary care doctor about this situation, especially because, you know, you're going to think about doing it when your kids are around 12 years old, and you might not have even had the birds and the bees talk with them at that point. So do you have any advice for maybe parents that hear this and they're like, you know, this is something we need to talk to our doctor about?
Well, you know, I think when you look at least the data and the purpose of the vaccine, you know, right now, you really have to ask yourself one question. You know, if I am concerned about the side effects of the vaccine, will I be, you know, to your point about the commercials that are airing right now, you know, am I going to be able to live with myself 20, 30 years down the road when I'm not having to deal with side effects from a vaccine? I'm having to deal with side effects of radiation, chemotherapy, surgery, and all those things associated with the ultimate cancer diagnosis. So I think that most, certainly the CDC recommends vaccination for boys and girls age 11 to 12. So if that's not a strong enough endorsement and is not backed by the, you know, family's physician, get a second opinion.
No, that's great. All right, so I wanted to shift gears again. You had mentioned earlier when we were discussing your diagnosis and how you were continuing to work that you were moving with a little more of a purpose. And I want to go back to that thought, and I want to talk a little bit about your memoir, A Walk with Purpose. So could you set the stage a little bit about why you decided to write the book, and tell our listeners a little bit about the story?
So I had a pretty interesting, I guess, career path. I started out as a computer programmer. That evolved into becoming a stockbroker. That evolved into being a securities analyst and a portfolio manager, and then ultimately the CEO of a couple of biotech companies. So I had always in the back of my mind thought, you know, that's kind of an interesting chain of, you know, careers, and mapping that out in a memoir might be an interesting, you know, challenge at some point in time. But I didn't see a New York Times bestseller hook to Michael Becker's interesting story of career, you know. And, you know, it isn't until you get cancer that suddenly you go, oh, well, now I got something interesting to talk about. And when the cancer came back, at that point, I really wanted to, you know, you start to really focus on what your legacy is, what you're going to leave behind, what mark you've made on the world. And it was those types of questions or thought processes that really gave me the impetus for the memoir, as well as the very, very, very strong encouragement of my lovely wife, Lori, who felt that it was a story that needed to be told, and that it was important in a number of different regards. So January of this year, I put pen to paper, or more appropriately, keyboard, fingers to keyboard, and started writing the memoir, really with the goal of telling not just my story, but how you deal with cancer and how you can still have a positive outlook on life. So, you know, my walk with purpose really is a memoir of my life and overcoming obstacles, which I've done from, you know, almost day one. This one, cancer is a little bit tougher, but I feel very, very fortunate to have the book published and out there, and the positive receptivity that it's received so far.
So how did you, with in and out of doctor appointments, in and out of treatments, in and out of work, find time to write this memoir?
In the early days, it was tough. And, you know, in January, January or so, I was still working and commuting from where we live, which is Bucks County, Pennsylvania, to New York, which is both where my employer was, as well as Memorial Sloan Kettering. And that's a hour and a half train ride each way. So that provided, you know, some very nice time to devote to writing or researching the book. And then as the, you know, treatments and as the disease progressed and it became not as easy to commute, working from home and doing consulting as opposed to working full time allowed me even more flexibility. And I would say towards the, you know, the tail end, I mean, the book was started in January, it was published at the end of April, so that's a relatively short time period for a 440-page novel. But a lot of that came from my blog, which I started from day one of cancer diagnosis. So all of the cancer story had largely been written. I just needed to look back at my blog and you know, kind of shape it and into a story. It was really toughest to go back to the early days of, you know, being a computer programmer and stockbroker and things like that and kind of piece that together. But it was also interconnected, and what really amazed me was, after writing it, just how interconnected everything was. You know, had I not become interested in biotech, I wouldn't have had all the contacts that I have. I wouldn't have all the knowledge base about cancer that I have. And so it really intrigued me how all those things just kind of came together to where I am today.
So, you know, at the Patient Activation Network, we talk about how you get the knowledge, skills, and education to become your own advocate and really take charge of your health. Do you think that having that background made you more likely to participate in the clinical trials, or is there something inside you that just really got you know, turned on to, I need to go do this no matter what the risk? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I definitely think that having a working knowledge of cancer and the treatment options that are available really did, you know, point me in the direction of doing the clinical study. You know, like I said, when you're diagnosed with stage four and you know that this is now terminal, you know, disease, and I should maybe backtrack for a second. So the first diagnosis that I got was, although stage four, that the treatment intent was curative, that if the chemo and radiation were successful, the goal of that treatment was to eradicate the cancer and be cancer-free. The second diagnosis, when the disease came back, still stage four, of course, but now it's terminal because it's systemic, it's, you know, traveling through the body, makes it very difficult to, you know, take any sort of a focal attack position on the cancer. So that mindset or that mind shift really forced me to consider, you know, things that are outside of the box.
Well, that is just amazing. You've got such an inspirational story. And for our listeners that are hearing you for the first time, you mentioned that you've had a blog about this. How can our listeners reach your blog?
So the blog is available at mdbcancerjourney.com, and that's simply my initials, M as in Michael, D as in David, B as in boy, cancerjourney.com, or everything is also linked to my main website, which is the website for the book, and that's awalkwithpurpose.com, awalkwithpurpose.com.
A Walk with Purpose is a great memoir. I'm starting to get through it, and you know, I look forward to hearing more from you here in the future. Do you have any closing thoughts, anything that you want to leave with our audience?
Well, I would think, you know, say that you hit the nail on the head, that you really have to be your own advocate, and you have to become involved in your diagnosis. And I don't think that's necessarily cancer specific. I think that could be almost any chronic disease. I think that there's a wealth of information available now, and yes, you need to be careful about you know, which websites you deem credible and which ones are, you know, maybe less so, but I think there's so much knowledge that a patient can obtain today that it would really behoove him or her to really research their condition, find out, talk to other patients. The internet has opened up a world of connectivity where, you know, we can reach out to people that have the exact same, you know, diagnosis or path as we do, and that can be comforting. You know, talking to my wife or my daughters, you know, they're very sympathetic and very compassionate, but there's still that sense of, you know, they're not going through it personally, and although they see the effects, it's I think it means a lot more to a patient when they can speak to another patient that either has gone through their experience or is going through their experience, and social media and other avenues have really made that possible. So get to know your condition, get to know the people that are suffering from your same fate, and network with them.
That's great advice. I want to thank you again for coming on here today. This is Michael Becker. His memoir, A Walk with Purpose, is available now. You can get it on Amazon. Also, if you go to awalkwithpurpose.com, you can follow his journey there. He's a great writer. He's a very inspirational story. And we want to thank you again, Michael, for joining us today.
Likewise, and Matt, you're equally an inspiration. And thank you for having me on the podcast today.
Thank you, Michael. And thank you for tuning in to the Patient Activation Network podcast. And we look forward to hearing from you soon. Take care.